Thank you so much for joining me. Danger Mouth here with Roberto Alejandro of OnBackground.com, and we're here to talk a little bit about what I think is a criminally slept on underground classic.
I like that.
Word of Mouth, which you released in 1997, correct?
Yes, sir. I like criminally slept on. That's pretty...
I think that's the only way to describe it. You know, I mean, and obviously that was kind of like before we had Twitter and Facebook and things like this. So it wasn't as easy to find out about music that wasn't from New York, LA, or your own backyard.
Right.
And, you know, and I got this album just because I had a friend who probably picked it up in New York. And, you know, it made its way up to where I was in a small town in Massachusetts. Speak a little bit about, you come out of Richmond, Virginia, correct?
Yes, sir.
Speak a little bit about the Richmond you remember coming up in that era.
In the Richmond in the 90s, of course, was led by Mad Skills.
Mm-hmm.
And I was learning, I was trying to get my rap legs together because I started way before then. I mean, I was rapping in high school.
Okay.
It was in the 80s. So back in the late 80s, I'm rapping in high school. And I was pretty good around the hallways or whatever. But after that, I went to college. And during college, I stayed recording during those time frames. But I was doing mostly songs. I had gotten away from the cipher. And my mentor, Bill McGee, was my college professor. I guess he couldn't be a professor in college. He's just a regular teacher. But he did become a professor. So he was the band teacher. And I was not in the band class. I just kind of came by. He was playing trumpet. And I noticed it. And I used to play trumpet in middle school.
Okay.
So I stopped by and I busted into class. And I was like, I didn't know you could play a real song on a trumpet. I thought you just could play marches. So
that's funny, playing
a real song. So I came in. I started coming to band class. And ironically, he knew my father. He played in a band with my father at Virginia State. So when I told him my name, he recognized that I could only be another Adolphus Maples. So...
Was your father the first musician in the family, or does he also descend from other musicians?
I think my grandmother. I hadn't thought about the lineage of music to now. My father was not around, like,
you know,
he was doing music. So,
sure, yeah.
So I actually wanted to stay away from doing music
because interesting.
I saw how it kind of affected my mom.
Mm.
And so I really tried to stay away from it. You know, because of that reason. So I did play in the band and I saw Bill McGee. And that's how I came into Bill McGee classroom through band class. So.
But you said you weren't in the class itself. Were you kind of auditing or?
No, I was. Yeah, I was being a class clown. And
okay.
So I was kind of, you know, roaming the halls and doing what kids do. And so I wasn't in my class and I just came by his class. So after school, I would come to band class. So I played in the band class. But I didn't have it scheduled.
Okay.
So, but I was in the band. And so he was first taught me with the trumpet. And so when he found out who I was, you know, he took me in basically because of the relationship with my dad.
Okay.
And so he had all of the cool keyboards and stuff. He was affiliated with a lot of cool groups, you know, back then, but he had started teaching. So he had he had the DX7. Keyboards. I mean, back then he had a 4-track. I mean, he had the cool equipment. So I was like, hey, I rap. So I'm just like, you know, this high school kid, just like, no, I rap. You need to produce me or put my record out. You know, I'm just saying all of the things that a little kid would say. And he was more of a, you know, you learn how to do it kind of thing, you know, but he started working on me. So the first record we did was actually a flip off Sly and the Family Stones. That break record that everybody was using, but he played horns too, so he kind of put the horns on it. Ba-da-da, 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 like where the break was on the Sing a Simple Song. It's the first thing we put together. So me and Bill McGee started to try to put our records together. While I was in college, that was one of his big rules. You know, if you want to do this music, you got to stay in school. So he definitely pushed me to, you know, finish education and stay in college. But during that time period, I was only rapping to make songs.
Okay.
So I only come back to do things. And I kind of got away from what was really important, which was the cipher. And I didn't realize how important the cipher was at that time. I said, well, I'm still doing music, until I was a big fan of the Fugees, and especially Lauryn Hill. So I had come back, and they were coming to Elizabeth City State. He was the professor at Elizabeth City State later on. Elizabeth City had a great big recording studio. They had a state-of-the-art studio at the time. So they had the big British mix boards and the Neumann mics. I mean, they had everything for that music department, and that's what he was the head of. So it was like a great deal for me to be able to work on music. So we were doing music, and I started tossing around different names. I had been AD and the maestro because he was the maestro. I'd been Pluck, which was my nickname. A bunch of horrendous things. A lot of bad decisions as far as names and promo pictures and things that people did in the 90s. Make a lot of bad choices. As far as. So when people heard me rap, they said, he sounds like the Fresh Prince. And that wasn't cool.
Yeah, certainly not by the mid-90s.
Not in the mid-90s. It wasn't cool to sound like the Fresh Prince. Now I would love to do anything that was like Will Smith, okay?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
But no, not then. So, you know, he was kind of like, you know, I've done everything I can. I got you sounding right. And people are saying you're whack. So I can't fix that. And so I went to the show to see the Fugees and Lauryn Hill. And that day, you know, they were in a cypher behind the stage, behind the thing. You know, they pulled up there in the van, they're rapping. I just thought it was like, you know, they're recording artists, but they're still, you know, in the cypher. So I came back to kind of get in the cypher, but I didn't really have any freestyle rhymes, really. Mm-hmm. And I hadn't, my chops were bad. I was cool in high school. I could freestyle in high school, and I had just raps that had no hooks, just like raps.
Yeah.
But everything I had now was a song with a hook. So at that moment, it was like an epiphany for me. Like, man, I'm not prepared to be in the cypher with the Fugees. You know, what am I say? One of my raps, you know, one of my songs, you know? So I talked to Wyclef after the cypher, and I was telling him that, you know, the whole thing, I'm trying to get on, I'm trying to make something happen, but it's not working. And he gave me some great advice. He said, there's always someone in your city that's doing it and doing it well, doing it big. You need to find those people and get with those people, because your association with people who are doing it and doing it good will bring your talents up. You know, so you just have to find a way to get around the people who are doing it, which is great advice, I think, for anybody that's doing anything.
You know,
you get around the musicians or the people who are doing video production, anybody that's doing it, and you're going to have to elevate your skills because of it. And I immediately knew that I had to come back to Richmond and get with Skills. And even though me and Skills went to the same high school, we were not buddies.
Well, you're not bad.
You know, so I knew him. I knew of him. And at that time, he was in the Unsigned Hype. He was traveling with, you know, Q-Tip and all that. So
I mean, for those who might be kind of younger and don't know, right? The Unsigned Hype was
in The Source.
In The Source. And that was, I mean, if you found yourself in the Unsigned Hype, I guess the closest thing today is like the XXL freshman thing that they do. But I mean, that was a huge deal back then. Right. And that's when The Source was The Source. Yeah. I mean, it was a different animal back then.
Mm-hmm. But so I came back to Richmond to find Mad Skills. And he was at a radio station, the University of Richmond radio station. Okay. I knew he would be there. He was there with Mike Street. Mike Street is another program director, still program directing radio today. And he was just had his own radio show because he was a student at University of Richmond. But that show was a hip-hop show. It was a station you could do anything, basically. And I don't know how many people listened, but it was just where we would do hip-hop. And they would play hip-hop. And then at the end, they would have a cypher. So that was one of the things that a lot of people tuned into was the cypher. And I knew Skills. So I started to come up there to kind of get my skills together, to be in the cypher, and to kind of just be on the scene. And so it was during those years of after 94, you know, from 94, that was when I came up with the name Danger Mouth. After I left Elizabeth City in that summer. So it was around the December 94, coming into 95. And Danger Mouth, I think I heard somebody on the television talking about Danger Mouse. Or they said that you have, they call a guy something derivative of a mouse, but it was the mouth. You know?
Okay.
So, you know, he's talking to him, he's calling Mighty Mouth. And I was like, that might be a cool rap name. Mm. So I just started thinking of different mouses. Mighty Mouse, Danger Mouse, you know. So I started telling people, you know, have you heard this rapper Danger Mouth? You know, just to kind of see if they thought it was whack. Because I had to kind of revamp everything that I was doing, from my voice, my flow, because they said it was whack. And I tell my kids this story, and I told other people, because it's different points. I think that people, you get at a point where things aren't working for you, and you do have to recreate things, which is, I wasn't talented naturally to rap. I've always been creative. I think creativity is my gift, but rapping as a talent wasn't my talent. So I had to kind of learn how to rap, which meant learning flow. So I used to pay attention to Chubb Rock, and Pharoah Monch was a big influence for me. Of course, you know, LL, the different people that I respected. I always liked the flow of, especially like Pharoah Monch, Organized Confusion. I know it's an old group for a lot of people, but it was a big, I wanted to get that flow and that voice. So I really had to, people would be like, if you're going to rap, you have to be distinctive. So when you get on the mic, people know that that's you. It seems obvious that somebody should know it's you when you get on the mic. But if anybody's ever recorded themselves, they realize that they don't sound like themselves when they hear themselves.
Yeah.
So that is something that you have to work on, to actually project yourself and to know that when you're saying, you're doing your voice, that's your voice. So there was a lot of time work, you know, just basically along that year. Stayed in my mom's basement. Was a substitute teacher because I said, well, I'll go teach during the day and come home, get off early and work on that. Didn't have a girlfriend, didn't have anything. It was just all about the music and trying to make it work, because I'm a fresh college graduate. I have no job. I don't know how I'm going to get a job in my major, which is pretty normal.
Yeah.
So, but it's got to work. Something's got to work. And so just in that basement was when I just started to make those records, producing on this Roland S550. I had a Voyetra sequencing computer. It was an old, PC. I mean, I don't even, it's nothing compared to what we use nowadays.
Yeah.
ADAT. You know, I had enough stuff to do it with, but just started making those records and going to the station and getting better. So it was a lot of time that there's records on word of mouth that don't sound alike. Vowel movement, I don't sound the same. And that's why I think if you really, when you talk about working on your voice and working on what you're going to do, and I knew that I wanted Danger Mouth to have a certain style, so I started experimenting with just this flow and just saying crazy things or things that, you know, kind of piecing things together. But if you listen to word, if you listen to vowel movement, I'm like, it's hard for me to understand why. I'm like, all up here. And then if you listen to Dangerous, I'm like, beware when in the presence of thee. It's like, I'm here with it. Blah, blah, blah. Like, it's like, what do I want to be?
So it
was still a moment of an album where I'm trying to find myself and figure out what's cool. And I didn't. I didn't know. The question was one of those records that became just this conversation about everything that works right now. I want it to work.
I want
this record to work. So, but what do I do? Because I'm being a student of, you know, vocal inflections and beats and flow, but also you can't ignore the content. When the same conversation that people have right now about rap and music is that it's, you know, where's my place in this? If I don't deal drugs, if I'm not messing with skills about this, now it's a plug, you know, I don't know the plug. So like, if you don't know the plug, how can I make a record? I gotta find out where the plug is. All right, but the same thing, you know, the trap, the hood.
If I didn't dress like I
just was a regular guy or just somebody that was a college graduate at the time, so not really fit the rap persona.
And
at that same moment in 95, rap started to change a lot, because we were a part of a movement which would be called the Backpack Rappers,
which was really
underground hip-hop, which, you know, I was selling word of mouth at the same time Eminem was selling the Shady EP on Sandbox. So I got to kind of be, I say know him, but be in the same boat as him and come across these same guys and the Roots. And, you know, I was on OK Player when it started, you know,
so it was like
that whole circle of people. You know, you turn on the TV and you see the Roots on Jimmy Fallon.
I know, man,
it's like a lot of things have happened since then, obviously. But at that point in time, we were all working on the same, on the same level of trying to get records out. And underground hip hop became kind of left because, you know, maybe what Puffy did, But I'll just say the music started to expand and be more commercial.
Yeah.
And a lot of things changed at that point. So we're trying to keep up. So it's almost like being in the style and then realizing that in the 90s, it's so much more for hip hop. A lot happened. And we were like backpack rappers about the lyrics and, you know, lot of, if you listen to 90s records, man, you'll find such a wide range of content and styles just in that year range, because, you know, you got Redman and you got Method Man, you know, the Wu-Tang Clan, but just so much, the commerciality was so prevalent that to change those records that what Bad Boy was doing, mm-hmm. it was like, well, I want a piece of that too. I want to have success like that. You know, you want the shiny suit.
Yeah,
you want
to
wave the watch around. I mean, you kind
of
like, yeah, I like Biggie, and Biggie was one of those people that found his place in between because he had the presence.
Yeah.
And that was one of those things I studied as vocals, because Biggie had a vocal presence that didn't matter what the track was. And when he rapped over R&B records, it was still,
yeah, it was still Biggie.
Biggie. It was like, man, how did he do that? I remember Skills brought back One More Chance, and we're like, man, he's rapping over the barge. I'm going like, wow, but it's hot. It's like, it's so gritty. Still, he found his place on it. So that was really, you know, important in that whole growth of being a rapper.
Yeah, and, you know, I mean, one of the things I really enjoy about Word of Mouth, which for some reason in my mind is titled Mouth of Madness. I don't know why that song title in my mind has become the album title, but one of the things I really enjoy listening to Word of Mouth is it does sort of harken back to those days, especially in the underground, like you said, in that backpack scene where it was about being a dope MC, first and foremost. It wasn't about the streets. It wasn't about really, it wasn't even about the beats oftentimes, right? Yeah. I mean, actually, Word of Mouth is actually, I think part of the reason it's a criminally slept on album is because the production is so good on it. Mm-hmm. You know, it has beats that, certainly if you're of a boom bap, you know, if that's your style, you're going to enjoy this album. But, you know, in the backpack scene, you didn't always have the best production or even maybe the most consistent production. Mm-hmm. But the MCing had to be on point. That was what was most important.
Yeah, I felt that when I was writing, I thought that I would get people to, I thought I would be successful by, I would write my way to success. I would concept my way to success. Mm. I would come with things that were so amazing that someone would be amazed, because I was producing the album, but I didn't know, I'm not that type of producer that was still going to be a Neptunes or a Timbaland Fuller, or just, you know, just trying to think of somebody that you would say, well, that's a successful producer. If you get them to produce your album, then you're going to blow up. I wasn't that guy. So I was just me making beats and digging through crates and finding samples. But I thought that I was going to be able to come up with concepts. And when concepts like Strange Fruit, you know, when you have a first person account of a lynching, 14 Ladies was randomly curious that you would take this scenario and where was it going?
This whole
story of the development of it was interesting enough, but it wasn't, you know, I try not to use curse words or try not to make it obviously, even though it was a sex story. Jack and the Weed Stalk, to me, when I wrote it, you know, I did research on all of these things. So now I can listen to these records like they're not me.
Sure, yeah.
And I listen to them and I go, wow, that took a lot to put all of those things together. But that's what we did in the 90s, is take time, and we really, you know, we cherished the art of being a writer. When we wrote, we tried to come up with things that were, to me, you know, just outstanding. And Jack and the Weed Stalk as a story that uses all of the things that it did in the manner it did, and we're able to conclude, even, you know, you're talking about a lynching story, but in 3/16, it's still your bed.
Exactly.
To be able to come and conclude in these things. And Like Flies, I rode on a plane going to Hawaii, because my job used to send me to Hawaii every year to learn the software. And I was flying over there and I realized that, you know, nobody gets out of our city that often, and they don't see anything more than their immediate environment. So they have no scope as to how small their world is. Mm. You know, if you go somewhere, you'll realize that. So in flying, and I thought about Like Flies and how to make things of flight and birds. But when it all came together, you know, I honestly think, man, artists just black out. And then you wake up and you go, like, where did that come from? Like, how did that happen? Because I was never, if you asked me who Danger Mouth was, I would not say he was a conscious rapper. But when if you listen to word of mouth, there's obviously some consciousness in this guy that's rapping.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, and I listen to some people think I was like a smart guy that's about, you know, trying to teach you something. But that was not really my goal. I just wanted to rap and just, but the, it was interesting how in the concepts and when you get a great idea, I'm definitely will take an idea everywhere it needs to go, you know? So, the scene here in Richmond for hip hop with Skills being one of those people, you know, we had a decent scene of rappers, but the station was almost like anybody who rapped here of that type of style would come to the station and they had to get in the cypher. So that's when we knew the Super Friends formed because of an alliance of different rappers in the city, as well as a disorganized union. During that time period, you know, everybody would come to the station and they would rap there. So if you saw them out, you ciphered, you rhymed, you just had to do that. But I didn't realize at the point that was a big part of being a good MC is being able to. It's just like jazz artists. If you're not able to come sit in on a set, you know, really, it's like, dude, what are you doing?
It's not for you.
Yeah, so you have to really be able to approach your craft the same way. And I don't know if people do that anymore. I mean, I definitely don't think that when I hear certain people, I want to, do they really work on their chops? Are they really able to just get into something and just, you know, just spit and just get in the cypher? But, you know, I see them on the TV and the award shows. They still have kind of slid those things in. So, you know, maybe they do.
Yeah, it's hard to say. I mean, especially because now, you know, the internet has transformed so much of the way music gets created and gets put out. You know, you could be an artist who just sits at home and does great stuff on their computer, but it doesn't mean that you're sort of out there proving your chops in front of other people.
The reality is that your success, really, because, you know, if you get down to it, if you're going to make a song, you make a good song, if you make a hit record, you don't have to worry about all of that. Just keep making hit records, make hot records,
a la
Soulja Boy.
Yeah, exactly. Which is weird for me because obviously, like, he's a good example, a huge star. But I think about, like, what his musical legacy is, and it's, I don't know. I mean, to me, it's like, okay, like, you had some hits, like some club hits.
It's interesting. Me and Lonnie talk about right now, if you DJ a prom.
Yeah.
You know, because if you have to DJ in the city, being a real DJ, you have to understand that you get older, where is your old school point? And so if you DJ in high school right now, your old school point is at Soulja Boy.
Okay.
And when you go to Soulja Boy, they lose their minds. But you're talking about, you know, 17-year-old, 18-year-old kids at that point. What is their old school? And so I always try to watch myself when I feel like I say something that sounds old, because I have felt like I was cool until the last few years, because I'm up there, but I was like, man, I'm not my dad's 40. You know, it's no way. Cause I'm cool, man. I can still rhyme. I can't be my dad's, 40 something guy. But the way the music is right now, my son is moving towards, I do feel old because now I can't associate with it. I don't have to play it. So when I don't have to play those records, I really go like, man, I don't care about them. I don't want to hear them. It's noise.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, but with respect to everything that happens in music and hip hop, I don't want to turn into the old grumpy guy that says your music is whack, my music was better, because that is what has always happened.
Sure,
everybody
definitely
feels like their music is better. I just want you to be exposed to everything so that you can not miss out on things. I said, like, son, this music was not during my time. You know, Stevie Wonder records that I play for you was not records that came out when I was listening, when people were listening to Stevie Wonder or Earth, Wind, and Fire.
Exactly.
So you have to be aware of this music so that you can understand the whole scene of what you're hearing. Everything is just not, you know, panda.
Yeah,
it's not banging. That's not what it's all about. It's not everything there is. So, and I think Panda is an awesome record, actually. I mean, I can hear it and hear the drive in it, and he actually is, I mean, his performance is kind of like, performing on it.
But
there are other records, the auto-tune and the singing and the futurish and the futuristic, and I don't know where the line is with it. Like, I go like, is that guy cool? Who is he? He sounds like the other guy with the auto-tune.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, a lot has changed, especially since the 90s.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think you're so right in that. I think in any field that you're in, it's important to know the history. And even if you take an album like Jay-Z's The Blueprint, if you listen to it, it's really an album that is an homage to classic hip hop, a lot of it from the 80s. You know, it starts off with a reference to Slick Rick, The Ruler's Back, right? Like that's, you know, he's remaking it for a new generation. If I'm not mistaken, that's like a 2001 album. Mm. And, you know, he's going back to stuff from the 80s. And it's kind of littered throughout that album. And, you know, if you don't know the history, you'll miss a lot of what Jay-Z is doing and what arguably might be his most important record, you know, depending on whatever debate you want to have or place you want to take in that debate. But I do think that that's something that is underappreciated, the importance of that. And, you know, today there's no excuse, right? Because in 95, where you would even go, I mean, you'd probably have to go to like New York somewhere and talk to somebody who just remembered the old days, right? Because you might not even be able to go to a library. There might not be books that you could look up or articles the way that today with the internet, you know, you can find out all this stuff on YouTube.
Well, everything is going to change. All change is not bad, but there is an impact and there will be an impact for this time period because what has happened is it's made music very disposable. Mm-hmm. So you get way more music. You can get it way easier, but nobody. So a lot of people don't respect what it takes to make a record and they don't respect it because it's so easy to get. They don't want to pay for it. They don't want to do a lot of things, but I don't want to put a broad stroke on it because don't know what the impact of all this will be. And I just don't want to be the old guy yelling like, this is going to be awful. You guys are messing up music for everyone. But there's going to be an impact. There's going to be changes. And when people talk about hip hop, you know, I like, you got to define what it is. If I have a kid comes up to me and tells me to play some hip hop, depends on where I'm DJing. Because like, you need to tell me what your hip hop is, little girl.
Yeah,
because if you ask me to play some hip hop, I don't know if you want to hear what I'm going to play. But with respect to it, and I think back to the way KRS-One has still defined what hip hop is, you know, and I tell these old cats that, dude, you cannot say your hip hop is hip hop because hip hop remains to be the culture of really young people.
Yeah,
and
it really
young
is.
People define what hip hop is. So if my son, you know, when I went to play the album after Word of Mouth, which was the 804 compilation, I was substitute teaching. I would take my MP3 player to school with me, which back then no one knew what an MP3 player was. I had a diamond MP3, the first one that came out, 64 megs, I think it was, of storage on that bad boy. But I took the music to the school, and then the kids would say, hey, let me listen to that that funny Walkman thing you got. And they would listen to the music.
Yeah,
but those kids did not care who it was. Their perception of music is very honest. So when it's whack, they say it's whack if they feel it's whack. You know, it's no reason for them. So that's why I have to respect any artist, young or old, that makes it to the approval of a high school student, for example, in that age, that 13-year-old age. Because I do believe that those kids are defining what hip-hop is. They know what they like. They know how they want to dress, or they put things together the way that they feel it. And they're not affected totally by, you know, they just do what they want to do.
Yeah,
you know,
why
did you do it? I don't know. I just did it. And so some of those things, of course, you watch the trends and everybody does what everybody else does. Like I'm cutting hair and now everybody wants to cut this, like, you know, the guy.
The football player. Top, yeah.
So, you know, so, you know, they do follow the trends. They do the same thing we did because when I was coming up, everybody was getting the same haircut. They had the same shoes. They cut their eyebrows. They did stuff that everybody was doing.
Yeah,
so,
definitely.
You know, we sit here and we go, our music or our time was great because we all have come up in it, but I'm very interested to watch the way music continues to grow, to see when people, like you said, well, what is your what's going to be your classic, dude? Are you going to have classics from these days of this music today? I don't know.
And in fairness to Soulja, I feel like Soulja Boy is kind of an easy target because he kind of made his bones in what became known as the ringtone era when, you know, the Napster phenomenon had kind of eviscerated music sales. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that everybody was just passing MP3s online. And what mattered at that point was, it could you get a song that was like a heavy radio single that could sell for 99 cents on iTunes, that you could convince somebody to actually pay 99 cents for? And that did a lot of damage to my mind to hip hop. And, I, you know, fans of other genres might feel like it did a lot of damage to theirs as well. But, you know, hip hop was always kind of an album driven genre. Right. It wasn't like just put out a song. Like, if your album didn't hit, then that was a problem. And but in the ringtone era, you know, it was like, this is why I'm hot. I'm hot because I, you know, like, it was like, you know, we got away from lyricism. We got away from complete albums. And we just had these sort of hooks and beats.
So but then when I hear Kendrick Lamar come along, I felt like, why am I not making an album? Mm-hmm. You know, because now I feel like, dude, you really had no excuse. Because listen to what this guy put together.
Yeah.
And look how successful he is. And look how well he's accepted. And, you know, you go like, dude, you're sitting there feeling like, I don't know what to do. Because for somebody like me at my age, of course, my family involvement, a lot of things cause me to just really have to do other things in life, which is just having a family. It's a big part of it. As soon as you have kids, everything's going to change.
Everything changes.
You cannot go do all of the other stuff you were doing. All right. So now you have a family. So, but what's interesting to your other point, I was just come across my mind, which was revisionist history, which is what we feel like, because it was during our time, we make some whack people classic. I mean, we think about certain people. I remember thinking about Too Short. I was like, you know, who really, you know, thought Too Short was good? You know, but when we think back, we put records in place and we even enjoy whack records from point in time. And nobody said it was good, but we appreciate Tone Loc. I mean, we appreciate, obviously, Sir Mix-a-Lot. We take those records for what they are. So you say Baby Got Back is a classic. It's like, really?
Yeah, kind of.
You gotta be, because I gotta still play it at the wedding.
Yeah, exactly.
This weekend. So at some point, you gotta give somebody respect for just coming up with a good record. But, you know, so right now, I don't know if it's gonna be more of those sugary records and not the substance that we have come to say, well, where's your substance in these time frames, in these days? And I don't know if we're gonna have substance or we're just gonna have fun records. And I don't wanna get into a box where we just go, that's fun, because we had fun records that were just, dude, it's just a fun record. It's dumb. Yeah, it is dumb. I don't know, but
yeah, that's the
I
point. Like it. Yeah, exactly.
That's the point. It's dumb. So if it's a dumb record, you know, I think that the content, the things that we are going through now, we allow a lot of things to happen on the radio. We start to get numb to records. You know, when you got Beyonce's new record, it's like saying middle fingers up. And so if I got that on commercial record radio, and then my son's here, and I was telling him, I said, no, it says little fingers up. I'm saying little finger up, and then say, wave bye with your little finger. But no, so, but obviously,
yeah,
as Rihanna records, Rude Boy, I mean, it starts to get like, yo, everybody's pushing the thing, and radio doesn't do anything about it. Mm. You know, how long did they get away with eat your butt out like groceries? Eat the booty. How long did that? I was like, yo, I even called the station here, like, dude, do you realize, do you hear what that is, you know, on the main station? Yo, so you got to get the clean. And you got R&B records that are not even clean. You sit here and play an R&B artist, and you that wasn't a clean edit. And so I think that's something we get now that I don't appreciate totally. It's just the amount of vulgarity, the unnecessary vulgarity in records. Mm. Whereas, you know, back in the old days, if you talk to somebody about Richard Pryor or, you know, Moms Mabel or things that they snuck and listened to that were records that people were like, you showing Red Fox. They snuck and listened to these records. Yeah. There was some like, yeah, but I got to go into my mode to hear this nastiness and this. Now, nastiness is just like right here for you. And they're going to say anything and do anything. And I think that that is possibly a detriment to a lot of different forms of music, is that people just saying and doing anything, because now it's like more of a shock thing.
Sure,
it's
like,
I'm pushing the envelope. And now you look at TV and then ass comes on. You're like, you can say ass, or you can say, then the next day, bitch. Damn, you can say bitch. You know, it's like you just you can listen to TV and you go like, everybody's changing. They're allowing you to get away with. But when we were making records, we cussed, you know. So I'm like, if y'all looking at night, we said a lot of stuff then too. And yeah. I tried to edit those records as much. If it said shit, I was going to get the SH and the T.
Yeah, yeah,
we're going to take out the I. All yeah, right. Yeah. You know, because that's why I'm editing records. So I got to remember when I was 20 years old, man, I wasn't.
You're in a different mind space.
So
yeah,
when
yeah.
The artist is in a studio, he's having a conversation with his friends. He's making a record for the people that are around him. He's not making about it. And I've been caught in that same boat with making. We did a remix of Tweet, just like the Aaliyah remix. And the Tweet record was Oops Oh My. She's talking about having sex with herself. So I'm definitely on the nastiest tip I can be, and I'm talking to Tweet. And they played on the radio, and this girl was like. Yeah, I came on the radio and had my daughter in the car, and I was just really like, and I was like, wow, I didn't think about that when I was writing it, but that's real life. So who does it come back to? Really, I think it comes back to the radio having to have more control over what they play and just really putting their foot down. But the radio stations are in competition too, and they want the listeners, so they kind of just do what everybody does.
Yeah, and most definitely. Let me ask, taking it back to word of mouth, and you mentioned the concepts, and you mentioned a number of songs, and I want to get to a number of the ones you mentioned. One of the things I really like about Jack and the Weedstock is that it's also an homage to Slick Rick, Children's Story. But it's kind of like what Children's Story would have been like if directed by Quentin Tarantino.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm curious, what were the influences that went into that story?
I don't remember everything about it. When you come up with an idea and then you say, well, what about this story? I don't know where it was going to end, because for me, when I did stuff like that, I would do the research. Mm. When I did Strange Fruit, I did do the research, because I'm more of a, I have adult ADD. I have it. Then I have some points. I'm not the junkie, the one that can't be junkie. What's that? What do they call those people that that have to have things in a certain place?
OCD.
Yeah, OCD. So a certain level of OCD. But when I create a record like that, I almost want to know everything about it. So I will go and just try to figure out, well, where are all the nursery rhymes before I start writing anything about it? Well, what were all the nursery stories? So I might take a minute to go through it and collect all those things together and then try to come up with something cohesive. So I don't know that I knew where it was going to end, but when I listen back now, I go like, how did he end up on the Brooklyn Bridge? I looked at the map. I remember trying to see what route they would go through to go to the Brooklyn Bridge. So let's go Chambers Parkway by the World Trade on the way to Brooklyn, thinking about getting paid. So we go across the Brooklyn Bridge, and then the Brooklyn Bridge is falling down. Everything about the Jack and the Weedstock and everybody they came in contact with, I think everybody had a place. And the thing that I admire about the record, you got to understand when I'm talking about these records, I have a hard time remembering that that's me. I know it's me, but if you are an artist or you're a rapper especially, maybe people will understand it. You're really not you until the mic comes on, until you hear your voice, and then you realize, oh, yeah, that's me. I don't know if it makes sense for anybody. It's just like, I think Beyonce talks about Sasha Fierce and some of this other stuff.
Yeah.
When you're sitting here and you're Adolphus Maples and I'm talking, but then if I start to say my rap, then I start to turn into that guy that I hear. And then when you go back, you kind of go like, it's like the Hulk. You go like, oh, I did that?
What happened?
All right, I don't know what happened. So realistically, any artist that talks about what they do, they can kind of speak from outside themselves. So I don't know if I really knew where that story was going to go, but I admire anybody's writing. And when I listen to that, it's times that I weren't able to achieve everything that I wanted to, obviously. Mm-hmm. But I think that record actually used so many things, and it used them in the great places. Like you said, the direction of where you came in contact with these different characters, what they were doing, and then melodically what songs they used and how the point got across to be able to get through that story without the fat. Without the fluff, because it'd be easy to me. You hear when people use fluff, you got to put filler in to anything to just to get through the time. But there wasn't a lot of filler in that record. It was straight to the point, and every verse, every line was something about the story or the fairy tales or somebody. And so I think that was great writing. And like you say, I thought that record on that album was still criminally slept on by people who even listen to the record. Mm. And sometimes I go like, but did you the Jack and the Weed Star?
Yeah.
Like, that was amazing.
Yeah, I mean, to me, there's a lot of great records on that album. I'm always curious because you're from Virginia, which to the minds of people in the Northeast is the South. And you're rhyming, I feel like, just before, like, the South blows up with Master P and then with Cash Money. Mm-hmm. Do you feel like the fact that you were from Virginia with a boom bap style in that moment in time where the rap imagination was still so East-West in terms of its binary, do you think limit your reach overall?
Well, Virginia or Richmond specifically is so close to the line that we only really acknowledge the South when you get to North Carolina.
Yeah, exactly.
So we here are at that breaking point. When you hear these New York people talk about, I went to Virginia, I go to Virginia, there was so much influence from New York actually in Virginia, and the people, we did not have a consistent culture here for the South. Like Atlanta's in the South, they had a consistent culture. Virginia did not, because of the transference of people. I think that there was a lot of people from here, so it made it difficult or impossible even now for Virginia to have a sound, because you can name several successful producers from Richmond, obviously, from Virginia. Let's go to Neptunes and Timbaland and all this. Obviously, they're successful people, but is that the Virginia sound? I think not.
No, yeah.
So you can't ever say that. So you can put some things in certain areas. You know what New York is like, you know. So I think that some of that was, you know, kind of, we weren't stapled in a certain way. We weren't painted in a corner a certain way. But I think that it was hard to make Virginia establish itself because we did not have a good home ground. And you would go listen to somebody rap and he would be like Master P.
You had
a down South rappers here that associated with that. And then you had backpack rappers that would sound like they're from New York City. So you have all of these different things happening right here. And I don't think you would have the same thing when you go up north to New York. Because at the time frame when we did the Aaliyah record, anybody that rapped fast was not from the East Coast. The Bone Thugs were rapping fast, and people forget, because I remember very clearly during that time frame, because I was going to try to write that record, that the only people that rapped double time was Bone Thugs and Harmony, Twista, you know. So you're talking about the Midwest.
The Midwest, yeah.
That's why Biggie, when he did it on his album, he had to get Bone Thugs on it, because that was only right to really, they really validated him, or they really made it sound like, I don't rap like this. Oh, I'm dangerous. Ain't no people in here. They say, I don't rap like this, but I'm just doing it because I got a Bone Thugs and Harmony type record. So when I was writing the Aaliyah record, I was hiding it from everybody, and I had it on my Walkman, the beat, because I was writing a freestyle for a mixtape for a guy from here named DJ Reese, who was doing this thing called 100 Lungs, 50 Tongues, 100 Lungs was his rap mixtape. He did a few of them. And so he wanted me to be on that. And I had the idea of rapping over the Aaliyah beat.
Okay.
So I said, but I don't want to double time rap. I don't want to be like Twista on this. I'm trying to find my place on it. So if you listen to my rap on the Aaliyah remix, I'm very deliberately trying not to double time over a fast beat, but I try to see the flows that I come with. Got y'all talking dumps about my crew and the things I do. I'm trying to not like when Lonnie comes on and others are there. So he's obviously like, that's Twista, but at the time frame, I was not trying to do Twista.
And he has the line, I ripped this, I don't even rap like this. Is it him or Skills who has that? That's Skill. I mean, that was always one of those lines too. But
if you hear, everybody is making a case for why we don't, this isn't called for.
Yeah.
I come on the record, real MCs can rip over anything.
Yeah, that's right.
Now, that is me making an excuse. I'm trying to set the groundwork for,
don't fault me for rhyming
Hey, look, this is not really serious. Don't take me serious. Like, it's screaming, and then it's so successful. It's like, please don't hold this against me.
Yeah. Well, is that, as an artist, frustrating when you have success for something that, to your mind, artistically, is not as substantive as you'd want to do, or is not the you that you wanted to project?
Yeah, I think it created, that whole thing created something that made it hard for me to succeed, because I was born into, from the 90s backpack rapper guy, about being an MC. Mm. So when it's a difference, when you hear people from the 90s rap, they did talk about being an MC.
Yeah.
And that was the crux of that whole time frame. It was your speech.
Yeah.
So you don't hear people, rappers, talk about being an MC now, or I take my skills are better than yours. It's like,
yeah,
you know, but if you listen to the way we rap, then everybody's talking about, well, my skills are better than yours, and I'm exactly. a better rapper, and I'm a dope MC. So that was what you know, you talked about. So the Aaliyah record was not for Aaliyah. It was for a mixtape. And I rapped on that beat. And when I finished, you know, that's why I rapped for so long. Okay. Because that was my whole verse for the mixtape.
I see. Yeah.
It was not planned. It was not set up. Obviously, if I was writing a verse for Aaliyah, I told this to Lonnie the other day. Every rap I write on an R&B record, I try to write it like in the context of what the person is talking about. So I probably know way out. I'm so conceptual. I'd be like, no, I cannot talk about just me rapping this beat. I'm going to have to be like, we were sneaking around. I had my shades on and we're going to, don't tell anybody, you know, that I'm coming and I'm going to get with you. If I knew I was going to rap on an Aaliyah record, clearly. Yeah. So, but that's why I said, well, really, what should you do when you approach things? Because we all mentally always think or overthink. I know I do.
Sure, yeah.
About how should I approach this? And I'm going to overthink it. So at times you go like, yo, you should have just rapped. No, don't think about it. Just rap, dude. And that's what that ended up being. So when we came, Mike Street was not at the University of Richmond. He was at the main station here, iPower. And Mike Street has a big role in why that record became what it was. Very quickly and I don't know, carelessly, he said, hey, if you put that rap in front of the record, I'll play it on the radio.
Okay.
Oh, really? So I just let him hear my freestyle because I was letting people hear it, and I would go up the skills. I'd be like, yo, what is this?
Yeah.
Because I didn't know what I had done. Same thing I was talking about with the artist. You come back, it's like the Hulk, you smash something, you go like, yo, what happened? Where are my clothes? You know? And so I take it to skills. I'm like, listen to this shit. He's like, yo, this is amazing. I'm like, I said, I don't know what I did. I don't know where it came from. I just did it. And so he's like, yo, let me get on it, and I'll send it to Timbaland.
Okay.
Because he signed to Timbaland at that time. Okay. That's in the, I guess, 98.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
So he signed to Timbaland. So it's like, wow, I mean, we got a direct path to Timbaland. I had been to the studio with him before and been down there with Timbaland before, and I was just the guy with them, his boy.
Yeah, that's right.
And just peeping out their game and how they did stuff, which they are. You know, the reason why they're successful is because they work hard. And I always tell people they did like 4 or 5 records right there while I sat in the studio. It's just like amazing. Yeah. So when he sent it to Timbaland, he said, oh, that's cool. Didn't say anything else about it. He said, that's all you said? He said, yeah, it's cool. I'm like, all right. So Mike, she said, put it in front of the song and I'll play it. I put my rap in front of the song. Skills is on the end. Lonnie B wasn't even on it when it got played the weekend that Friday. Lonnie said he wanted to be on it. But a little bit of information, I don't know, your listeners don't care. Well, I guess when the book comes out, we expose all of the secrets. Skills didn't want Lonnie on the record.
Okay.
Because he said it felt like it was going to be like me trying to put all my boys on a record, and I'm the one that signed to Timbaland. If we don't have all of this, like my whole crew is on this record, it may be more believable. Mm. And the whole time I'm like, when Mike Street announces, hey, it's the new remix of Aaliyah, and I look at him, I go like, yo, you cannot say that.
Yeah.
What do you mean? This is not the remix to Aaliyah. He's like, Super Friends on a remix of Aaliyah. And I'm like, that's not what it is, Street. You can't say that. That's my verse. And I'm trying to keep DJ Reese's little part in the beginning because I'm like, yo, it's for Reese. Keep DJ. No, take that part out. So we start to like, he has it. And then people are like, yo, can we get that remix to Aaliyah? And I'm like, yo, it's not Aaliyah. Can you even do that?
Yeah.
And I remember having this conversation with Funkmaster Flex, because Funkmaster Flex is who really, when he dropped the bomb on it and he rewound it, he's like, kept going back to my part. And I'm like, yo, that's so crazy. Like, he keeps playing my part, and it hasn't even gotten to Aaliyah yet. And he's dropping the bomb on it. And that's when you know when you really have something that works. And I tell that to the young cats all the time. It's like, man, if it hasn't worked yet and you don't know it's not working, just keep making records and keep working, because when it works, you'll know.
Yeah.
Now, if you are struggling and trying to keep shove that thing through the hole, just go to something else. Just go to your next record and keep making records, because if you keep making records, one of those are going to work. Mm-hmm. If that one's not working, don't keep them, because I've seen records work. And it was so easy after that. It was just like everything just started falling into place. And Funkmaster Flex is like, yo, so let me get this straight. Y'all just like took the record? And I was like, no, I mean, I just rapped on it. I did it. He said, so this is like an unofficial remix. He said, yo, I didn't even know you could do that. He's like, this is crazy. This is bananas. Yeah. So before that time, nobody had done an unofficial remix of a record. Now, clearly, yeah, a zillion unofficial remixes. People drop on them now. Sure, but that's an important point that I almost think that we almost invented the unofficial remix, because nobody even thought it was an unofficial remix because nobody was doing it. But we weren't selling it, so nobody could say anything about, oh, it's for sale. It's just like, okay, you guys better get this BDS because it's spinning around the nation.
Yeah.
And then,
I mean, how did you get it onto the Dr. Dolittle soundtrack as opposed to just getting sued by Aaliyah and her team?
The success of it and the play of it, and people loved it. Mm. I mean, it's almost like, why are you going to be mad at something that the people love?
Sure,
and
yeah.
People wanted to play it, and the power people in New York, you know, how much they really have a lot of influence over the whole...
Flex cosign in those years was, right. I mean, forget about it.
Yeah, so what are you going to say? You're not going to play that? And even here in Richmond, they don't play our remix like that. It might come on, but in New York, that is the version that they play. Even today, if I go to New York and they play Aaliyah, it's going to be my version.
Yeah, I mean, if somebody plays Aaliyah and it's not that version, I'm kind of like, why are you playing this version?
I've said that to the station before. I said that, yo, the station says, told you that on Power 9-2. How is it that Power 9-2 doesn't play our version? They play the regular version. I was like, I know it don't play that record that often, but it comes up in rotations at times. I'd be like, why would you ever?
It's funny, too, though, that you mentioned that, you know, you wrote it not thinking that it was an official remix, so you weren't writing it to the song, and so you just spit, because I do remember, like, I would listen to that song by, like, skipping the Aaliyah part, you know, like, listen to the Danger Mouth, skip over the middle part with Aaliyah, and then get to Skills and Lonnie B. And so it's funny to hear you say that, because it does sort of make sense to me why now I like that record so much.
Right. It was a very unusual track. I mean, I don't think it was such a unique beat that Timbaland did, and I just wanted to figure out a way to do a unique rap flow, because I didn't think Timbaland had touched it, really, what he did.
For anyone who hasn't heard it, go find this song, because it's a nasty verse. You know, that verse you throw down is nasty.
Right.
Let me ask about Like Flies, if I can. You mentioned a little bit earlier, you know, that aspect of a lot of people in Richmond, you know, never get out of the neighborhood. We see that certainly a lot in Baltimore. You know, you have people who grew up West Side, haven't even been as far as East Side. You know, it's bad in terms of that tendency for people to stay in their own little world. Mm-hmm. What was Richmond like in that era? You know, what was informing that inability of people to sort of see more of it?
I think it's the same type of thing that happens in every hood or every community, is that people are very comfortable in what they know. Mm. And we get comfortable with what we know, and we don't venture outside of it. It's people that work a job for 50, 60 years of their life, and they get a watch at the end.
Yeah,
and you go like, so you stayed in that same job. Was that an achievement for you? Yeah. I mean, so they make it like an achievement, but really it's just like, dude, you just didn't do anything else. You just kept coming every day.
You didn't try
anything else. It's pretty depressing when you think about it. But so when you talk about the comfort level of people and the ability or the exposure, or even just, you know, having someone, because Bill McGee, he's a teacher, he did do that. He did the college tour. So a lot of those kids, he got a bus and he took them to different colleges, went to Atlanta. So he took the kids out of Richmond so that they could see. And it's very important for any educator or any parent to give your child a world scope, because they will think that their friends are cool. Whatever they have in this area is cool.
But when
you go somewhere, you get off the train in New York City, you just go, man, this is moving way faster than anything around me. These people are getting it. You know, it's like you can tell, you can feel it. Like they're about being successful. They want to make money. They're grinding. You go like, oh, man, I got to get up here. You know, if you go to California, you get a different feel. If you go anywhere, you just go, just being exposed to it will change you. Mm-hmm. But people don't have the same opportunities to travel. People don't see the importance of traveling. There's grown people that look at a lot of things that I do and we do, even just in my relationship with my wife, where we travel and we go places. They're like, dude, just spend your money. I mean, you bought, look at what you bought. Just instead of buying that, just go on a trip.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
just
definitely
go somewhere. Don't. So they have the money, but they just are comfortable where they are and don't really see the reason to go until you go. And it's been that way for years, and it'll probably always continue to be that way. It's just sad. So I don't know how we make, how we change that, other than for people who do go places to continue to at least uplift their children, their students, to bring them and expose them to different things. So that's why I like flies, was just one of those things. That's why I wrote that.
Yeah.
Traveling. It was just because I felt bad that, you know, and looking down on the little houses and then going over the water and being in Hawaii, the plane ride was 13 hours. But then you land, you go like, man, nobody's ever seen any, you don't see the sand and put your toes in it and look at how blue this water is. You know, like, it's not something that you would ever see, you know, in Virginia. The Virginia Beach is,
they don't look like that.
I was like, I don't even want to swim in Virginia Beach. I go like, no, that water is awful.
Yeah, I wanted to ask about another line in the song, because, you know, part of the hook is, as long as the mighty eagle rules the sky, black men keep dropping like flies. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you mentioned not sort of thinking of yourself as a conscious rapper, but there's definitely some conscious elements. That line, obviously, that song and Strange Fruit is definitely an example of something that could be thought of as conscious. But especially now in the sort of era of Black Lives Matters, I'm curious what your thoughts are, having rapped a line like that 20 years ago, on the progress you've seen in terms of state violence against black bodies in America. I mean, what are your thoughts on that? Because literally 20 years ago, you're saying something that you could say today would be a fresh line, right?
Mm-hmm. A lot of it is interesting as far as rap is, and even things from back then. Like you say, you could say the same line now and it still holds the same fact, and it's sad because you had the same things going on. Mm-hmm. But you still have to remember that even back then in 94, when I was putting all this stuff together, was when OJ was being chased. That's Rodney King, you know, was before his time. So a lot of that stuff, I don't think we knew it would continue on. But it's sad that, yeah, as long as the mighty eagle, that eagle was money, you know, like you said, state government, it's just everything.
Yeah.
You know, as long as this happens, black men dropping like flies. But also, even I want to be fair in my context of everything. It's why even at Strange Fruit, I talked about the lynchings, and that lynching was old, but even still, my conclusion or my point was really that, you know, we do a lot of things to ourselves nowadays that we don't, you know, we do, these things happen and we're dying and we're killing each other, and those things haven't changed, you know. In fact, so it's just that there's been different modes of it, because I was coming up with Crips and the Bloods were just really heavy, and it's like, oh, they're killing each other because it's gang violence.
Yeah.
Now I don't know what they're doing. They're just like shooting each other, or they're just, it's other reasons, or just they just do it because they don't value anyone's life, and they just think that, you know, you see these kids and they're quick to, nobody's gonna go the same way like they used to. They're not gonna fight you. Somebody's gonna go get a gun.
Yeah.
You know, so we have a lot of things to, as a community, to be able to try to get through. But it's really bad because you feel like the police are something that's here to serve and protect. So the more that it gets exposed and the more you see these things, they continue to happen.
Mm.
You know, it's just, it's sad. Because
do you see that conversation in terms of the issues that have to be addressed within the community really taking place? And do you see hip hop helping to push that in any way? Or do you think that we're still not at a moment where we're ready to look that conversation in the face?
I don't think we're looking the conversation in the face yet. I think that there are certain people that are doing it. You know, overall, we try to see, well, who is someone that's part of the black movement or someone that's supporting, you know, you think about Martin Luther King's or things that happen during different moments in time. You have Al Sharpton is the person that speaks up. Well, who are the other black leaders now who, You know, you kind of look around and wonder who they are, or who's speaking for them, and where is the place?
Yeah,
for them. So I don't know. And some of it now, you know, I have my own kids. I have three kids, and when you start to have your own family, you know, of course, I care about the city, but I'm most immediately I'm trying not to screw up with my three, you know, because I have three boys, so I don't want them to, I don't want anything to happen to them. Yeah. What I feel like when my heart is sad and heavy is when I see when something like a Trayvon Martin, because I can really associate with that because I have a young child. When you watch it, something that you go like, you know, I'm telling my kids to stay away from this. I'm not telling them to stay away from certain situations. So what, how can I ever protect them from it? Or really what is my, it's so many things that happen when I know that kids doing normal things and they die. Mm. Like, how did they just die? How did they die from that? They shouldn't, nobody should have died in that instance. And so especially when you're saying, I don't want you to be in this part of town. I don't want you doing these drugs. I don't want you with these gang members. And then, yeah, they die by a cop. And it's like, well, when a police officer stops you, you don't talk back. You don't do anything, yeah. Dude. You just listen. You get down. You show me how you do it. Whatever you do, do not, because you will die.
Yeah.
You know, so that hasn't changed. And, you know, but I'm really on it because I have boys. And I want my boys to grow old, man.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
No, it is crazy. I mean, it's crazy that any parent has to sort of consciously think about, because just like you said, I mean, there's sort of the dangers everybody has to think about. Mm-hmm. And then there's like the specific dangers people of color have to think about that are unique to their sort of existence and reality. And it's insane. It, for exactly the reason you're saying, like, you have three young children and they're children,
right?
You know, and they could get killed by an adult with a handgun. Yeah, I mean, something about that circumstance has to change fundamentally. Mm-hmm. But
I don't know. I don't know what the solution is to it, because they are, you put it on, there's certain things, I think, like assault rifles. It's everybody, you have a certain part of, and we're in a very political time right now with this election, and nobody wants to anybody to take their guns. And I'm not a gun owner. Because I'm scared of guns, actually. I don't like guns, and I don't want to have one in my house, per se. Now, you always go through, you know, my friends have guns, and I think about it, well, maybe I should have a gun for protection in my house, because what if this that happens? And I've toggled with it, and I go to the gun range, and I'll shoot a gun, but my father was killed by a gun in 94, you know. So it was times when I've really just go like, man, I really just don't like guns. But these assault rifles and things that happen when you go like, my child is in the elementary school. So I sent him to elementary school and he didn't come home. These are concepts I have. I go like, what is happening with the world when you can just send your child to college? He's going to go to college and get a great education. You're like, hello, what? Yeah, your son's gone. Your child is gone. I just sent him to school. What do you mean he's gone? I didn't send him to the, you know, the projects in the hood. He wasn't going. He went to school, dude. And, you know, so you got crazy people shooting people. But I think that there should be a ban on just even assault rifles. Shouldn't be available for anybody that's not in the military, or just why would you need to shoot that many rounds? You know, I understand people want to hunt. Cool, right, dude. I don't have a problem with one shot, though. You're not going to kill up the whole school.
Yeah. But, and I mean, even in the military, if you're in the military, it's not like you get to take the gun home with you. You don't sleep with it next to you in the barracks. You know, at the end of the day, you have to give it to the quartermaster, and they have it behind lock and key, and they keep track of everything that comes in and out of that space. And yeah, I mean, we have a very problematic relationship with the firearm here.
Well, different people are raised differently. And I know that, you know, I try to respect people's the way they've been raised, because obviously everybody has a different mindset. And when you look at Democrats and Republicans, it's like you say, how do these two sets of people view the same thing totally differently? How did they hear this word and hear the exact opposite? But when you look at Democrats and Republicans, man, they hear exactly the opposite from each other. And they're like, wow, that's interesting that human nature is like that. But you still got to know, dude, does that person really believe it? Like, if I'm talking to you, it's like, yo, he really believes that. As much as I believe it, So I've got to respect his belief to a certain degree to say, like, well, you know, we talked about lynching. And when I see people doing as much as they were doing about the Confederate flag, it's at a point I'm like, yo, they're really going overboard with the Confederate flag thing, because I really don't give a shit if the Confederate flag is on the back of your truck, dude. I mean, mm-hmm. just do your thing. If what it means to you is you what you associate from it. I don't have to look at that flag and think that, oh, you are with lynching black men, or you are with this whole mindset of it, because historically all these things had a place in our world, and I came up on one side of that. So whereas I don't want it on my property, I don't want to look at it, but I don't have to, you know. We're in Virginia, and these monuments are all up and down Monument Avenue. And we're surrounded by the Civil War. We're surrounded by a time that was not good for black people. So if you live here, you're constantly reminded of some of those things. And you say, well, why did they make a big statue of this guy? But then in retrospect, and also they've got like Harry F. Byrd Middle School, and they're going to change the name of the school. You know, they start to do things that I think that, other than say white folks, but they try to compensate for the damage that's been done. And I think they almost start championing this whole thing. And I'm going like, yo, so who gave a crap about did I know that was the guy? But I mean, if I went there, but just like the Confederate flag thing, you know, they made it so you can't have it on your license plate. And I'm thinking like, dude, I got to respect that man. Just respect me and how I feel that maybe you should, why you can't have it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, part of my concern is on the policy end, that especially when it comes to the black community or communities of color who are struggling as a result of poverty, especially, that we tend to expend a lot of energy on these debates.
Yeah.
That, you know, it might move a statue. And look, I get the symbolic weight of that, but we spend a lot less time talking about things that might make a much deeper impact in people's everyday lives that might, for example, get someone to leave that 3-block radius in Richmond Baltimore.
That's like, I was talking that conversation about like this whole Western medicine thing and treating the symptoms versus going to the source of the problem and really trying to go like acupuncture or cupping, where people go to the source of the problem to try to cure something. When you try to go to the source, then you may deal with more of your education downfalls, or what is happening with the incarceration percent, or what is happening, why are not more black men raising their kids, you know, what is happening in the community to end up where we end up, you know, because there is a source and there's a place where these things begin. And so we may have to make it so that people are easier to survive, or make it so that they don't turn to these other things. Because what happens when, and I tell this to my kids, you're looking at these guys you're surrounded by, everybody's not going to end up the same, man. You're going to look around 20 years from now, and that guy that you were playing basketball with, he's going to be strung out on drugs. Mm-hmm. This guy over here, you're going to run into him at the drive-through of Wendy's. But not to say that anything working at the drive-through wrong with that, but you don't expect these people who are on your same level right now, they're going to live different lives. They're going to make different decisions. But also, people are going to go by what they feel is in their drop-down menu. What is available to me? Mm-hmm. It seems like it's grayed out, so I'm just going to do what I view as success in my community. Is the person who is the coolest guy, the guy selling the drugs, he's got the money, he's got the car, he's got the women. So why wouldn't I follow this role model? Because that is what I know as achievable success. Mm-hmm. You're talking about get an education, it's boring, and stay in class. I don't see why I should. And if we can get back to affecting the youth, because when you sit and you look at a young kid, I got a 7-year-old, a 12-year-old, and a 13-year-old. I watch the same kids they hang with, and I've gone and done, and I DJ in the projects here, right? And I look at these kids, and the kids are all the same, right? So then you look at the adults in the same thing, you say, well, she has no teeth. She's obviously a crackhead, you know, but they're in the same. So you go like, well, how does this little girl, what is her fate? Because she lives here with them. So right now, she's just happy and dancing to the music and everything is all great because she's a kid, but she's also in this environment. So she's going to be infected by her environment some sort of way. Maybe she'll be stronger because of it. Maybe she will be resilient. But maybe, you know, it's just like she won't be because everything is right there, and why not escape from it by doing the drugs? Or why not just roll with somebody who does something against the law?
Yeah.
But so if we can somehow get to our children and it just try to affect how their existence is and make it easy for people to be successful. Does that make sense? Like, how do you make it easier if you don't make it so that the opportunity is are equal across the board?
Yeah, you know?
Because it's for me, I came up middle class. Parents didn't pay for me to go to college, but I was able to work it out through working.
Yeah.
So I didn't have all of the opportunities, but I didn't come up destitute. So I don't know, man.
Yeah, no, it's an incredible challenge. And, you know, I think that's a question for all of us to ponder. We've been here over an hour. I thank you so much, Danger Mouth, for your time. Word of Mouth. If you haven't heard this album, Criminally Slept On, one of the underground backpack classics, absolutely, of the 90s, check it out. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.